All right, good evening, everyone. Nice to see you tonight. It is our last evening together in the discussion group. And I wanted to just extend some thank yous, some now and some at the end. But first of all, to the MSU libraries, I have some representative of our public relations directors here tonight, Ruth Ann Jones. And I want to thank the library, and there was many people within the libraries that helped put this together. Thank you to the MSU Muslim Studies Program, which Dr. Khalil is the interim director of, to the Islamic Society of Greater Lansing, and to the East Lansing Area Clergy Association. They all really helped get the word out about this program. Also, thank you to the MSU Honors College. We've got some honor students here. Yay, Heather. And the Michigan Humanities Council, who also got the word out to their lists. And the national organizations who sponsored this, the National Endowment for the Humanities and the American Library Association. So that's some big thank yous. To the individual graduate student discussion leaders, I wanted to say thank you so much. You know, through your very, very busy schedules, and you know, someone even took comprehensive exams today. So I want to thank Ebru, Aaron Webb, Jihan Abdullah Muhammad, Adrian Tyree, Miriam Zaman, and James Wright. So can we give them a thank you? Okay. And also thank you to those of you here tonight, very committed participants, committed to learning about Islam and learning from each other, as well as from Dr. Khalil. And we're going to save our thank yous to Professor Khalil at the end. Tonight we have somebody taking photographs that we might use to promote this type of programming. So you'll see Lewis around. We also have, I mentioned Ruth Ann Jones. We'll probably be writing an article about this project for our library newsletter. So actually, if you, would you like to say something real quick about that?
Well, I too want to thank you all for participating. I will be doing an article about this program in the library's next newsletter that we send to faculty and donors, people who help us make the library better by giving us lots of money. If any of you would like to share your thoughts with me about what you've thought of this program, how it's your reflections on it, please see me. And you can either give me comments tonight, or I've got my business cards. You could email them at your convenience. I would really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth Ann. Tonight, unfortunately, James, if you're in James's discussion group, he's sick, so he's not here tonight. So please join one of the other discussion groups. And if you're having trouble hearing in this Ebru's group or Miriam's group, please go to one of the rooms that the doors close in. You might have, hopefully you'll have better luck there. Just a few more announcements, I'm sorry. This event, which I announced last time, the one about biblical texts, about our Samaritan manuscripts, I announced it last time. There's been a change of time, so it's at 7:00. So if anyone was planning to go to that, note that the flyer you took last time was incorrect. So the time is at 7:00. And you know, while this is our last discussion group, we have one more event that's related and hopefully complements this programming. On April 10th, Dr. Khalil will be lecturing on his own research. And I think you'll really find that a treat. And you'll also hear you know, voices of contemporary Islamic scholars and preachers and writers through Dr. Khalil's work. Okay, last announcement is that there is an exhibit related to Rumi's poetry downstairs on the first floor between the elevator and the door in a flat glass case. So check that out on your way out. And I'd like to welcome Dr. Khalil.
I'd like to give a very, very, very special thank you to Deborah Margolis. She's been working tirelessly to put this together for over a year now, and You know, just looking at her hard work, I mean, just she made an extra name tag for me today. How did she know I was going to forget my name tag? Please join me in thanking Deborah Margolis for all her hard work. Oh, and I lost my sheet.
I'm sure that was me.
Well, assalamu alaikum. All right. Tonight, we're going to discuss Sufism, or in Arabic, tasawwuf. What is Sufism? Often, people define Sufism as mysticism. And that's too simplistic. That's simplistic. Here's a definition of Sufism that I think is widely accepted. And that is, it is an orientation of self-purification, transformation, and realization. And one hadith that sort of highlights the perceived role of Sufism is what is called the hadith of Gabriel. Now, let me just take a time out here. Hadith. What is a hadith again? A report about the Prophet. It's a report about something the Prophet said or did. Okay. So there's a hadith called the Hadith of Gabriel. And it's a famous hadith, a popular hadith. It appears in the most famous hadith collection. And it states that one day a man came from the desert and he looked mysterious. His clothes were exceedingly white, as it states in the report. And his hair was exceedingly black, and no signs of journeying. You'd imagine if somebody's coming from the desert, they would have sand all over, right? This person was completely clean. And he approaches the Prophet in front of his, while he's with his companions. And the Prophet is seated, and this strange man sits before the Prophet and places his hands on the Prophet's thighs. And he asks him, what is Islam? Now, what does the term Islam mean?
Surrender.
Surrender or submission, right? And the Prophet responds with the five pillars of Islam. Islam, submission to God, is to declare that there is one God, to pray, to give to those in need, to fast, and to visit the house, to perform the Hajj, which we talked about last time, the pilgrimage. And then this strange man asks, what is Iman? And what does Iman mean? Who knows? Say it again. Faith. Yes. For a student. Yes. Faith. Faith. And the Prophet responds with what are called the pillars of faith, or the articles of faith. And so it's to believe in God and to believe in the prophets and the books and the angels and the day of judgment. And the idea that God is in full control, divine decree and power. And this is seen as a stage above Islam, to have faith, to put your trust in something that's going a step further than merely surrendering to something. And then this mysterious man asks, what is Ihsan? What is Ihsan? Excellence, perfection, you could say. And there are other definitions, but we'll just stick with that. And the Prophet responds, it is to pray as if you see God, and though you cannot see God, God sees you. And this is often taken to be an even higher level. You're not just praying, you're not just worship, you're actually trying to feel God, recognize God's presence. And Sufism or Tasawwuf is basically it's based on this idea, this concept of Ihsan. We want to go beyond the do's and the don'ts. We want to go beyond the requirements of the faith. We want to perfect ourselves. We want to experience God. And although it is often defined, and so that's why I stress here that it is both intellectual and experiential. You're trying to experience God, but you're also thinking about how you can become a better person. And although it is often defined as Islamic mysticism and the mystical dimension of Islam, Sufism is actually a broad term that encompasses other orientations. For example, asceticism, which is the earliest Sufi orientation to flourish. And this is the idea that you live a simple life. You don't get distracted by the material world. You focus on God. And another orientation that becomes popular shortly after the ascetic orientation picks up or takes off is the love orientation, popularized by Rabi'a Adawiyya, or Al-Rabi'a Al-Adawiyya. This is a woman who lives nearly a century, a little over a century after the Prophet passes away. And her story is interesting, and there are different versions of the story, but the Cliff Notes version is, this is a woman who came to appreciate love of God as the highest form of love. She saw love of God as the highest form of love. And for her, that is true love. And she would write poetry about her love for God. And she has a very famous prayer where she says, "Lord, if I worship you in fear of hell, burn me in it. And if I worship you in hope of paradise, keep me from it. But if I worship you for your own being, don't withhold from me your everlasting beauty." And it said that one day she was walking through the city holding a torch and a bucket of water. Can you imagine? And the people ask her, "Rabi'a, what are you doing?" And she says, "I'm taking this torch to burn paradise. And I'm taking this bucket of water to cool the flames of hell. Because you people are too obsessed with going to heaven, not going to hell. You've missed the whole point." That was Rabi'a. And so we see these other, and you know, so these are two orientations that are popular in early Islam, the ascetic and the love orientation. Eventually, we find the mystical orientation flourishing. And we see this, of course, in the poetry of Rumi, the author of the poems we had to read for today. And in the mystical writings of Rumi, you really see all of the orientations of Sufism. You see the ascetic orientation, you see the love orientation, and the mystical. And let's talk about the mystical here. Islamic mysticism, the goal here is hidden truths. It is going beyond the apparent wording of the Quran. The Quran, for instance, prohibits Muslims from eating swine, from eating pigs, pork. And maybe in Sufi discourse there is a discussion of how it's not just simple prohibition, there's more to it there. There's something symbolic there. You avoid the nature of the pig, maybe. Something along those lines. You go beyond the explicit. And in Islamic mysticism, there is this desire to experience God. And so you go beyond Sharia. Sharia here we'll just define as Islamic law, just to keep it simple. But we've discussed this earlier, as you recall. And the idea here is you go beyond the do's and the don'ts. You try to experience God. Rumi, in one of his poems, says, beyond right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. Now, this is the most contested form of Sufism, this mystical orientation. And some will refer to it as the heart of Islam. Others will refer to it as not Islam. So one thing you should be aware of is that Muslims respond to mystical Sufism in very different ways. And within mysticism, you have two orientations. And one is relatively popular, and that is what we could call sober Sufism, sober mysticism, where you don't claim that God is everywhere, but you claim that you can experience the attributes of God. God witnesses you. You witness God's creation. You make that connection. And this was very popular historically. And if you look at the most influential scholars in the history of Islam, people like Al-Ghazali, for instance, maybe the most influential, he promoted this kind of Sufism, sober Sufism, as it's called. But then there's also another form that's also pretty popular historically, not as much, and this is the most contested, though, and that is intoxicated Sufism. This is where the boundary between us and God is removed. And you see God as all. Now, does that mean that you are a pantheist? This is interesting. I mean, in your reading in the introduction, that's how the author presents it, and that's what many have assumed. But actually, I know some scholars of Sufism who would question that. They would say, no, it's not pantheism. We believe that God is all, but there is still something there. But in any case, we don't have to get into that debate. In the case of Rumi, he clearly promotes what we could call intoxicated Sufism. God is all. And I won't get into what that means exactly, because it's something that scholars debate. What does it mean that God is all? But let me tell you the story of Al-Hallaj. Al-Hallaj, as you see here, dies in 922 of the Common Era. The story goes that he was meditating, reflecting, and he reached the conclusion that, you know, he experienced God, and he arrived at the conclusion that God is all. God is everything. I am nothing. And so he went out and he proclaimed, "An al-haq, I am the truth," which is one of the names of God. Now, that's controversial. A human being saying, "I am God." And you will see Muslims ever from that moment on debating this moment, debating the authenticity of that experience, debating whether what Al-Hallaj experienced was real or not, and debating whether it's appropriate for him to say this or not. Some would say, no, this is actually perfectly fine. Rumi says that, if you notice the last poem that was assigned. When Al-Hallaj says, "I am the truth," he's really saying, "I am nothing." So it's actually, he presents it as a sign of modesty, a sign of humility. And this goes along with something that many Sufis say. There's a famous Sufi saying that before God created the universe, God was and we were not. And after God created the universe and created us, God was and we were not. Even after the creation. So this is a popular theme in intoxicated Sufism, and we might call intoxicated Sufism. And this is clearly in Rumi's writings. This is the most contested, I think, aspect of Rumi's thought. But make no mistake about it, Rumi is still, you know, he's not somebody who just picked up a book on Islam. I mean, he's somebody who is a scholar, and this is now in his late 30s, 40s, he's beginning to say these things. Doesn't mean that people necessarily, that many people don't accept it, but they respect him or they accept it. I mean, just depends on which kind of Sufi you're dealing with. Okay. All right. Now, just a brief note about his life. He was born in Balkh, which is in Central Asia, in a part of the world that is in current day Afghanistan and Tajikistan, actually. And as was common during this period, he flees the Mongols. This is something you see throughout this century, this would be the 13th century, and also even the 14th century, with somebody who is critical of Rumi, and that's Ibn Taymiyyah. You see many scholars fleeing their lands because of the Mongols. And of course, the Mongols will eventually become Muslim, in at least those Mongols who were in Muslim lands. Most of them will eventually become Muslim themselves and promote Sufism themselves. And actually, as I'm saying this, I'm reminded that we have a scholar here who works on one of the Timur, a Muslim of Mongol heritage. But in any case, he flees the Mongols, performs the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, and then settles in Konya in present-day Turkey. And as I say, he was a scholar and a Sufi poet, somebody who studied Islam and had what he describes as sort of a spiritual awakening, and would produce some various popular works, and I list here the two most well-known examples. The Divan, or Diwan in Arabic. A Divan would be the Persian pronunciation. Of course, he's writing in Persian, Farsi, right? And he also, and this work, the Divan, is dedicated to his spiritual companion, you could say, Shams of Tabriz. And he also produces the Masnavi, or Mathnawi in Arabic. And this is his most popular work, his magnum opus, if you will. And this work is sometimes called the Persian Quran, because it conveys the message of the Quran using the beautiful Persian language. And if those of you who are familiar, I know those of you who speak Urdu, you know that the Persian language is a beautiful language. Some of the best poetry in the world is produced in Persian. And as I stress here, a recurring theme in Rumi's writings is this idea that God is all, and that our demarcations are artificial. And there's a famous saying of Rumi. He says, "I went to a synagogue looking for God, didn't find him. Went to a church looking for God, didn't find him. Went to a mosque looking for God, didn't find him. Looked in my heart, and I found him." So the idea that God is in us all, and really us all of humanity, Muslim, non-Muslim, these lines, these demarcations, in Rumi's mind, are artificial. God is in everything. This is an idea that you see in some earlier Sufi works also. It's not as if Rumi is coming up with this. One scholar that comes to mind here is Ibn al-Arabi. He's someone that I'll probably mention in my lecture in a couple of weeks. He developed an idea that would later be called, he didn't call it this, but later be called Wahdat al-Wujud, the idea that God, there's oneness of existence. There's only one existence. It's one of those things that some people see in a very view in a very positive light or in a very negative light, depending on their orientation. And finally, I'll just mention that Rumi inspires the creation of a whole Sufi order. So during this period, the 13th century, you have many Sufi orders forming, and especially in the 14th century, 15th century, and these Sufi orders, or tariqas, or tariqat, it's basically you have a system where you have a sheikh or a sheikha, some kind of spiritual guide, and students, the murids, and the sheikh is trying to guide them to become, you know, closer to God, to get them to attain the goal of Sufism, right? Self-purification, realization, and so on. And Rumi, after he passes away, later years, he eventually, you get this the Sufi order inspired by him called the Mevlevi order. Mevlevi because he himself was called Mawlana. Mawlana or Mevlana, I guess Mevlana would be the, I guess, Persian pronunciation. And Mawlana being, you know, our, that's a good definition. Lordship, someone to whom you grant authority. And the Mevlevis are well known because they're the whirling dervishes of Turkey, right? And we actually had a scholar last week at our conference, the Muslim Studies Conference, reference the origins of this the whirling movement. And the story is that Rumi is walking through the bazaar and he hears the metal workers, you know, and then he begins to spin. And the idea is that you're losing yourself in God, right? And what they'll do is they'll usually have a hand like this and a hand like this, and they'll begin to spin. And they'll spin and spin. And I'll tell you, after just one spin, I feel dizzy. So I don't know how they do it. It's amazing. It really is. And so they'll spin and spin and spin and spin for a long time, and usually they'll have, they'll form like, you know, they'll spin around a sheikh or a sheikha, some kind of spiritual guide in the middle, and they rotate almost as like as if, you know, the planet's rotating around the sun. And again, you're sort of losing yourself in God. There are different ways that Sufi orders will do this, that they'll remember God. The whirling dervishes, of course, are well known. There are other forms, there are other ways. In Egypt, it's very popular on Thursday nights, and I've never actually seen this in person, but I've heard about this. On Thursday nights, they'll gather in mosques, and you know, many people will just kind of say again and again and again, Allah hay, Allah hay, Allah hay, God is alive, God is living, again and again and again. And so, the common thread here, or the thread that you see throughout all of this, is this idea that you remember God. That's the goal here. You're opening the heart, the eye of your heart to God. Put it that way. Okay. Well, with that, looks like we're out of time. So let's go ahead and split into groups, and then we'll reconvene. So thank you. Well, while we're waiting, there was a question, and that is, what is the Baha'i faith? There was a question about that. And actually, we have someone here actually who's with the Baha'i faith. Maybe he can, he's not here at the moment, but maybe he can do a good job of supplementing what I'm going to say. The Baha'i faith was developed, you could say, in the 19th century. And if you're looking at it from a historian's perspective, it comes out of Islam. And the idea is that there's a new form of revelation in the 19th century through the figure of Baha'u'llah. And Doc Martin, you can help us. There you go. We can say Baha'is. There you go. Yeah, so there was a question about the Baha'is. So I was just saying, the most important figure you could say is Baha'u'llah, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong there. And Baha'u'llah, the claim is, the idea is that Baha'u'llah is receiving revelation. And actually, I have many relatives. I never actually met them. I only met one. But I have many relatives who became early Baha'i, who were part of the early Baha'is. And one was actually the one who tailored the clothes that Baha'u'llah wore in his famous portrait. And interestingly, I have another relative who broke off her engagement with the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hassan al-Banna, because he found out about our Baha'i relatives. It's really interesting. That maybe wasn't the most satisfying answer, but many similarities between the Baha'i faith and Islam. I mean, the Baha'is accept the Prophet Muhammad, but again, there's this idea that there's a new form of revelation, I think we could say, in the 19th. But of course, it's all connected to the earlier revelations.
Yeah, when you're talking about the progressive revelation, Abraham, right.
Right. Thank you. You came to the right session. So.
Always.
Okay, a couple of points here. First of all, there was a question, what percentage of Sufis are what we could call intoxicated Sufis? Remember we talked about sober and intoxicated Sufis. What percentage are intoxicated Sufis? And I said, in a place like Egypt, I would guess maybe 10%. Well, Miriam Zaman, I don't see her here at the moment. Oh, there she is. Miriam Zaman, soon to be Dr. Miriam Zaman, and we would say here, inshallah, which means God willing, she said that she feels it would be much, much higher than in a place like Egypt. She said maybe in Pakistan, maybe even as high as 80%. So, and we talked about how, the role of Sufism as far as conversion goes. If you look at the spread of Islam into South Asia and then into Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Malaysia, and then also sub-Saharan Africa. You see Sufism played a big role there. And even here in America, if you look at, many people who convert to Islam, significant percentage will come through Sufism. Okay. And last point, before we take questions, God, the concept of God. You know, Rumi talks about seeing God in all of us. And so one question that comes up is, well, what does the Quran say about God? Where is God? The Quran says that God created everything and then mounted the throne. So there's that. But it also says that God is with us, right? You know, if there is a group of people, God is there also. If there's a verse that says that God is closer to people than their jugular vein, we could translate it that way, than their jugular vein. There's a verse that says that everywhere you turn, there is the face of God. So when we're talking about the Quran, you know, you have these passages. So what do you do with that? Different Muslims will respond in different ways. Someone like Rumi would see this as, yeah, God is closer to me than my jugular vein, yes. Other Muslims would say, well, no, that's God's awareness. It's not God physically or God's essence. So that's an interesting debate. Okay, let's open the floor for questions.
What is the meaning of life?
What is the meaning of life? Oh, look at the time. I gotta go. That is. I'd rather watch the Wisconsin game.
I just learned that, I mean, in the U.S. at least, he's read a lot, I mean, his books.
Yes. Yeah, Rumi is a, let me just stop you, I'm sorry. Just quick point. Rumi is actually a best-selling poet in the U.S. I mean, he was, in 2002, Time Magazine published an article saying he was the number one poet in America. And I think maybe in 2008, he was also at one point number one. I mean, he's certainly a best-selling poet. And in many years, or many periods, the best-selling poet in America. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I can see like how a Christian or a non-believer can just read it and not necessarily even think about Islam. So is that like a purposeful way of writing the poetry, you think, or?
Well, you know, so from his perspective, he wants to tear down all the barriers. You know, he wants to tear down all the barriers because he wants to just see God. So you can see how that could then have mass appeal to people outside of Islam. I mean, if you imagine he's talking about the, you know, if he's just talking about Islamic things, then it's going to be, you know, limited to a Muslim audience, right? But here I want to just pause and point out something. Mm-hmm. And this is the point I make in my book. There's this assumption that Rumi is a kind of, a through and through pluralist. We have to be careful because, you know, in Sufi poetry, there are contradictions. And it's okay from the poet's perspective because, there, as I said in your group, there are multiple layers of truth, right? So, you know, you can contradict if you think of one layer of truth contradicting with another layer of truth. But in any case, but there are some poems where Rumi criticizes a Christian for being a Christian.
Oh, are there?
He says, you know, how could you do this? You know, why, you know, clearly... You know, you're not using your mind. It's complicated. It's complicated. And it's, you know, and that's it has to do with the contradictory nature of the poetry, which, again, he's perfectly fine with. Because, again, he sees there being multiple layers of truth. But then in another passage, he describes how Christian, Jew, Muslim, they're all...
Yeah.
Right. And you know, churches, mosques, synagogue, you know, in some poems, you would get the sense that he's indeed a pluralist, but then in other poems, no, he's not, and then it's complicated. So that's the point I'm making, and actually, it's a point I'll make in my lecture 2 weeks from now, shameless plug. Okay, next question.
A couple of the poems mentioned predestination, and I kind of refuted them, or refuted the idea, so I wonder if you could talk about that idea in Islam, and sort of the idea of fate.
You're saying Rumi refuted it?
Yeah.
Well, I would be interested in that because, again, there are multiple layers of truth. Because the Sufi poets, and here I'm more familiar with his predecessor, Ibn al-Arabi. Yeah, I wrote a chapter on him, so I spent some time with him. And Ibn al-Arabi, we can assume, influenced Rumi. At least Ibn al-Arabi, he actually accepts predestination. He accepts that. At one level. At one level, he assumes that everything is determined by God. Every single thing, every thought, everything is determined by God. But there's another layer where you assume that we are free to do good. And so how do I reconcile the contradiction? I don't know. I would I guess here I have to kind of, you know, just mention my limitations. You know, here I defer to a scholar who has spent his or her whole life studying Rumi. I'd have to be careful with that. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
Well, I don't mean even just Rumi specifically, but maybe what he was referring to in broader Islamic beliefs about predestination or about fate.
Do you have a particular passage in mind, maybe? Not to put you on the spot. Yeah, maybe we'll do another question while he's looking it up. Yeah, that's a good question. Let's do another question while he's looking that one up. Oh, there we go. Thank God. I was going to say another question. Okay. Put all the pressure on him.
Well, first of all, I think predestination is 96%, 4% screwed up. You figure it out. You can go in any place you want it. But I was looking at Rumi, and so much more than I've read. He seems to go beyond a sect or religion. He seems to be going to a point where, like you're saying, God is everywhere. So if you can find it in Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, whatever it is, to me, he seemed like he was really good at breaking those barriers that seem people artificially created.
Let me tell you about his predecessor, Ibn al-Arabi, because that's what I'm familiar with, and because there's something similar going on there. In Ibn al-Arabi, and he's, in case you're wondering, he's a scholar from Muslim Spain and Andalus, who moves and ends up in Syria. Okay, in his writings, he says, God is all, God is everywhere, and you can reach God through idolatry. You can reach God anywhere. But you attain perfection through what he would call the Muhammadan path. And so everyone reaches God, but if you want perfection, you go through the Muhammadan path. And it seems that Rumi is going along this, following this line of thought. You can reach God any way, but if you want perfection, then you go the way of the... And that's why I think he rebukes the Christian companion in one of the poems that I mentioned. And Ibn al-Arabi says that everybody will... You know, there is an afterlife. How we imagine, if it's physical or metaphorical, we don't have to worry about that. But the point is, there is an afterlife. And if you follow the Muhammadan path, you are in paradise. If you follow God through Christianity or through Judaism, and you're not rejecting the Muhammadan path, you also go to paradise. For him, a big thing is how you see the world. If you see Muhammad as a true prophet, then you have to follow him. But if you don't see him as a true prophet, and let's say you're exposed to, you know, everything about Islam, if you don't see it as the truth, you're not responsible. And so for him, you could then reach God and perfection in heaven through another path. But if you see the truth of the prophet, and then you reject it, and you insist on remaining whatever it is that you are, then you go to hell. But because God is all, for Ibn al-Arabi, even hell will eventually become sweet. He says, and I'm kind of spoiling my lecture for 2 weeks from now, but that's okay. He says, of all the words God uses for punishment, he uses the Arabic word azab. And this word, if you look at the root, it's azaba, and that's related to sweetness. So he says the punishment, the azab, will become uzuba, sweetness, when God's mercy overwhelms his wrath. And this is actually from a hadith. The idea that God's mercy overwhelms or overtakes his wrath. So he says, when that occurs, even the people in hell will begin to enjoy hell. Can you imagine this? And he says their nature will change, and they will become fire-like, and they will act, if you're fire-like, hell is great. So they begin to enjoy hell, but they remain veiled from God. The person, so they're enjoying it, they're loving it, but they're not experiencing the ultimate pleasure. Because the ultimate pleasure is not the physical, it's actually beholding God. And for him, that's the big difference. Believe it or not, there are some anti-Sufis, we might say, who even go a step further. And I'm trying to tease you, to encourage you to attend my lecture, yeah. Okay, other questions? Oh, did you find the passage?
Yeah, it's in love and life.
Yeah.
Will Poe then still pretend to be unfree and clamber out the predestination's tree? And I sort of read the whole thing as talking about
using predestination as excuse to not be responsible for your own actions.
Okay, that makes sense. because he certainly believes in predestination.
Okay.
But using it as an excuse, this is a common thing. And you even see it even in recent years where people will just kind of say, well, why do this? If it's written, it's written. And there's a kind of just kind of a lazy attitude that develops from that. So you don't even bother to try to do anything. You just, well, if it's written, it's written. And so that's what he's critiquing there.
Okay.
Which is interesting because that attitude of using predestination as an excuse is often associated with Sufism. And so it's interesting that Rumi here is actually challenging this within Sufism, interestingly. Yeah. Other questions? Thank you for taking the time to find the passage. I appreciate it. Oh, we have a question here.
Hi. I was curious about Rabia Adawiyah.
Yes.
The idea of not being religious because of fear or because of the dessert at the end, like.
Right.
So that was appealing to me, but I was wondering how was she received.
How was she received? Good question.
When she was alive.
Yeah. Yeah. No, even now we can ask how was she received even now. Well, certainly she was very popular. We know that people would flock to her, and she had a large following. Men and women would come to her, and she was, she actually, by the way, never married, interestingly. And men and women would come to her, and she was their teacher. I'll say this. I'll give you two different things here about how people receive her today. One, I'm on the Hajj. And I speak to a sheikh, and I ask the sheikh, what do you think about Rabi Adawiyah? If I worship you in fear of hell, burn me in it. He says, it's nonsense. So that's one approach. Another approach, in Egypt today, there's a movie from the 60s made about her. There's a mosque named after her. In fact, if you've been paying attention to politics in Egypt, Rabi'a, pretty significant, because that's the mosque where you had a confrontation between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Egyptian police. And Rabi'a, in case you're wondering, the name Rabi'a means the fourth. And so that's why you see many Egyptians with this symbol here. They'll do four. In reference to what they perceive as the tragedy of the mosque, Rabi'a Mosque, the Egyptian army was killing innocent people who are associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. So yeah, there's a famous mosque named after her. Actually, as we speak, my wife's uncle actually passed away yesterday, unfortunately, and they're holding a funeral, I guess you could say, gathering at that mosque tomorrow. He's not associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. That's just where they're holding it. It's a popular mosque in Egypt, and so people receive her in different ways. I would say, on the whole, though, people tend to have a more positive view of her than a negative view. That's the impression that I get. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you so much. It's been great.
Thanks, Dr.